Here's what I learned. Do you guys know this?
Sure.
Do you know who invented karaoke?
It's actually up for debate.
If you want to look at the machine that was created by a gentleman named Inoue, is that right?
The first like commercial one, Daisuke Inoue. But
Daisuke Inoue, yes, yes.
But yeah. Are you going to say Mitch Miller?
I was going to say Mitch Miller.
It's like he read my secret file.
Okay, then
I'm gonna argue that Sing Along with Mitch is not karaoke, but I'll save that for the main episode.
There's a lot of things I can argue against Mitch Miller. So,
yeah.
Hello and welcome back to The Greatest Song Ever Sung Poorly. It's a karaoke podcast that is the direct result of when boredom meets fandom. I am your severe antagonist right now, Adam Wainwright.
And I'm on the hero's journey. I'm Ed Kennard.
I'm saying I'm a severe antagonist, everybody, just because before we started recording, Ed thought I was going to start talking and I sat there looking at him with my hand in the air for about 40 seconds. And if you could see the look on his face and how, like, he's like, come on, can we please just fucking start? It's late. It's late. I want to go to bed. Just start, Adam. Just start.
I'm old. I'm sleepy. I appreciate you finally starting.
But a hero's journey shouldn't be about being old and sleepy. That's not how a hero's journey begins.
I'm at the end of the journey, Adam.
You're at the beginning of the journey, Ed. You need to find the energy. Get back on track. And let's rock and roll. We have an entire episode of really, really awesome, exciting stuff coming on. We're going to have more informational content in this episode, episode 19, than we've had in the previous 18 combined, I think.
That's a fact.
Yeah.
Actual research went into today.
It did. We actually brought in like a historical expert. It's going to be a blast, y'all. But right at the top, I just want to take a minute to acknowledge, because I think it's the closest we've ever recorded to our actual release date. It's one of the closest times we've ever recorded to our actual release date, to acknowledge the loss of a true genius. And that's not even a good word, of his time in Stephen Sondheim. You know, there's been lots of things that have been said out there and a lot of opinions and a lot of memories and things being shared. And it's just one of those things where I think it's still setting in for me what his influence on our culture is, on musical theater, on something that has become deeply ingrained that I love very, very, very deeply. It's one of those things where somebody said that it's like watching Shakespeare work in his own time. He was the Shakespeare musical theater. And it's just wild to me that, you know, I don't know if I fully appreciated watching this genius work when he was here. But now seeing all the memories of him, looking back and the impact he made in shows I truly, truly love with all my heart. Assassins is one of my favorite musicals of all time. And all the other work he's done, it's really, really sad to see. But God damn it, has he given this world and musical theater and this thing I love so, so very much. So while he'd be missed, like, I don't think there's ever, you know, it's a cliche to say his work will live on, but I don't think it's ever been more true.
You're going to have to find a karaoke spot finally so you can sing a Stephen Sondheim song.
Yeah, if I can. Stephen Sondheim, man, he was, man, that dude, the way he did music, the way he layered things, like, we're never going to see it again. I just don't see it. I mean, he's influenced so many people that are bringing like little pieces of what Stephen Sondheim did into their work. I know Lin-Manuel Miranda is very heavily influenced by Stephen Sondheim. So I don't know. I just wanted to acknowledge it off the top and like just throw it out there because it's in the zeitgeist right now. We rarely have an opportunity to do so. But what's happening right here in this moment on The Greatest Song Ever Sung Poorly is it's, I believe, my turn to challenge you, Ed. So Ed, would you like to be challenged today? Are you feeling it? Or are you too tired and slow to deal with a music trivia challenge?
I feel like I don't have an option to say no. So I say we roll with it, Adam.
Speaking of role,
put me on the spot.
Let's put you on the spot. So I've created a very, very, because you've been doing these elaborate trivia music beds for these segments, and I feel like I'm not contributing. So I lazily, to a certain extent, put together this wonderful trivia bed. And I really, really hope you enjoy it, Ed.
Trivia time, trivia time, trivia time, Ed, are you ready? Music trivia is fun, oh yes, you must admit. It's trivia time, Ed, are you ready?
I don't even have to ask if you did that, because I absolutely know your singing voice.
Yeah, 100% I did that. Yeah, so that is your music bed. That's your introduction for today. And we're doing some music trivia, and here's what I have in mind. Because of the nature of our guest being a music archaeologist and your very extensive knowledge of music and music trivia. Like, you are a music trivia all-star. You brag about how you win all the time and go out. So if anything, we're going to put that to the test. And if anything, this is going to help prep you for the next time you're out and about a music trivia. The way I'm going to structure this is I'm going to put 5 minutes on the clock. I have an endless amount of questions in front of me. I want you to see how many questions you can get right in that time span. So I'm going to ask you the question. Give me an answer. If you don't know it, just pass and let's see how many we can get through. And if you had a guess on how many questions you're going to get through and guess correctly, what's your guess?
8.
I'm going with much, much more than that, Ed. I really am. I think you're going to get more than 8. I think you're going to get a lot more than 8 in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Because some of these questions are not rocket science, and you do have the option to pass. So
it does also depend on how long your questions are.
They're quick questions. These aren't going to be a lot. Most of them are very quick answers. There are a handful that are a little bit longer, but I don't know if we're going to get to those.
There's no essay portion then.
There's no essay portion okay. of this trivia. That's going to be interesting for the future, though. Ed, are you ready to start the shit? On your mark, get set, go. In The Big Lebowski, the dude can't stand which band?
Oh, I have no idea. I actually hate that movie and everyone yells at me for it.
Well, it's the Eagles, and that's fair. Who founded Motown Records?
Berry Gordy.
Good. Before Phil Collins, who was the lead singer of Genesis?
Peter Gabriel.
Great job. What was Madonna's first top 10 hit?
Pass.
Holiday. What rock star moonlights as a horror movie writer and director?
Rob Zombie.
Excellent. What film did The Clash's Joe Strummer direct starring some of his bandmates?
Pass.
The movie's name is Cops and Robbers. Eminem's 8 Mile is named after a road in which city?
Detroit.
Hell yeah. Who was Marvin Gaye's duet partner?
Tammy. Pass.
Tammy was right for the first name. The last name is Terrell. Tammy Terrell. Paul McCartney credits which artist with teaching him everything he knows?
Buddy Holly.
Little Richard was the right answer to that one. What artist made up the supergroup The Traveling Wilburys? If you can give me 3, I'll give you credit.
Tom Petty.
Yes.
Bob Dylan.
Sure.
I'm going to have to pass. I'm blanking.
The other 3 members of the Traveling Wilburys were George Harrison, Roy Orbison, and Jeff Lynne. Who was the first woman ever inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Oh, Aretha Franklin.
There you go. Yep, it was Aretha Franklin. Okay, so Paul McCartney and John Lennon wrote which Rolling Stones song?
Pass.
I Wanna Be Your Man. Which member of NSYNC was a replacement for another who quit before they got big?
Lance Bass.
Excellent. That was right on. So believe it or not, Jimi Hendrix only had 1 top 40 hit. Which song was it?
All Along the Watchtower.
Nailed it. Great job. So who is the only country artist to have a top 20 hit on the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart for 6 straight decades? She is still alive and kicking today, kicking the shit out of some COVID.
Dolly Parton.
Dolly Parton, hell yeah. We love Dolly around here.
Thank you for the hint.
Yeah, no problem. Art Garfunkel initially declined to sing one of Simon and Garfunkel's biggest hits solo. Which song is it?
Sound of Silence.
Bridge Over Troubled Water was the correct answer. What was Elvis Presley's first number one hit in the United States?
All Shook Up.
Heartbreak Hotel. Van Halen famously banned what color M&Ms in their rider?
Brown.
Yes. What other legendary vocalist is a cousin of Whitney Houston?
Dionne Warwick.
Hell yeah. The Day the Music Died refers to the tragic deaths of which artist?
Buddy Holly, The Big Bopper, Ritchie Valens.
Yes, that's right. What singer is known as the vocal Bible?
Not pass.
Brandy. Which classical composer was deaf?
Beethoven.
Excellent. Which rock stars were known as the Terror Twins? I'll accept the band, too, that these brothers were in.
Did you say Terror or Terror?
The Terror Twins.
Nah, that didn't help. Pass.
Steve Clark and Phil Collin of Def Leppard. Prince introduced his iconic symbol on the cover of which single?
Pass.
1999. What does Stevie Ray Vaughan name of his most beloved guitar?
Pass.
Jimbo. David Crosby said, who is the best singer of all time?
Melissa Etheridge.
Bonnie Raitt. Good guess, though. What book do the police reference in Don't Stand So Close to Me?
Lolita.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, the last one. My timer is expiring, but I'm going to give you this last one right now. Where was Tupac Shakur born?
New York City.
Where? That doesn't work for me. Not when we're talking where is this person born in hip-hop. It does not work just to say New York City. That's technically correct, but where in New York?
Brooklyn?
No, he is not a Brooklyn baby. He's East Harlem, New York. East Harlem, New York, Tupac Shakur was born. And you did pretty well there, actually. I think that went well.
I think so, too.
Yeah, you bounced back. Like, you kind of, like, there were some moments in there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, once you settled into your groove, you really got going. And I thought that was appropriate, you know, bringing a little actual music trivia in there, something that people can, like, play along at home and, you know, say, oh, I can't believe you didn't get that one. Or I'm like, well, I can't believe I knew that. Either way, that's what I imagine people's voices that listen to the show in my brain noggins, that what they sound like. But I thought it was appropriate considering our topic today is talking a little history, right, Ed?
Right. I mean, when we get to the interview segment, we'll talk about some rock music history. But for our purposes today, it just seems like we should get into some karaoke history, don't you think, Adam?
I mean, that is what we do on this podcast, right, Ed? We're karaoke podcast, so we might as well talk about some karaoke history, which I don't know if we've ever properly talked about. We talked about, like, origins and, like, generalities, but not, like, that good history. You know those good facts you get, Ed?
I do know those good facts, Adam.
So, Ed, you listen to more music history podcasts than I do. That's just a fact in the world. You listen to a lot of music history podcasts. What's the structure here? What do we do? Talk me through how to do a history episode of a music podcast. Where do we start?
Well, I mean, we're a karaoke podcast, so the temptation is there to try to do it and sound like someone else is doing it really successfully. But we're not going to do that. We're just going to talk about the origins of karaoke, and we're going to let you know where it came from and how it got here.
Ed, is it that simple, though? Is it that simple that you can just tell me what the origin? Okay, so we'll start here, Ed, and I'm going to ask you this question because there has to be an answer to this. Like, an undebated, undisputed, 100% answer to this. Who created karaoke?
See, that's the thing, Adam. The origins are shrouded in mysticism and secrecy.
What?
I mean, okay, they're not, but they're debated, and we don't really have any hard and fast things to say for certain that this is the one true creator of karaoke.
Well, who are the contenders then, Ed?
Well, we have Shigeichi Nagishi. He's credited with creating a prototype in 1967. There's Toshiharu Yamashita, who sold an 8-track version in 1970, but most places settle on Daisuke Inoue as the creator of karaoke, although he never profited on the invention he created and popularized.
How did he not profit on this? What happened
there? He never patented his singing machine.
Oh, you gotta patent the singing machine.
Do you want to know where he first made his money, though, Adam?
I mean, he was a musical genius. He gave the world karaoke. It has to be something music related. So yeah, tell me about the guitar he did patent. You know,
it is as musically related as me trying to perform a song in public and, you know, not hurting people's ears. He developed a pesticide solution to keep cockroaches and rats from destroying the electronics inside of karaoke machines, and then later from licensing karaoke music.
I mean, I guess that's important too, is, you know, because you can't have the cockroaches all up in your karaoke machine. If there's one thing, can we pause for a little PSA right now to all you karaoke jockeys out there who may listen to this podcast? There's one thing I can say for sure, that as an adamant consumer of karaoke, please keep the cockroaches out of your machines. Thank you. End of PSA. Ed, continue. Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to make sure that was out there in the world. It was important, I thought.
Absolutely important. The first person to really make money off it, though, actually was from the Philippines. Roberto Del Rosario patented the sing-along machine. So he's the first person who really made money from the devices themselves.
Just from my experience, I know it's huge in the Philippines. Like, having a karaoke machine in the Philippines is just something that every family has, I believe. So thank you, Roberto, for bringing this into the world. I feel like I interrupted you again, and I'm sorry. I'm just trying to add a little flavor to all the beautiful, beautiful facts you're bringing to people's ears.
Nobody minds a little flavor. Now, if I can go off on a tangent, though.
Please, wonder.
If I have one pet peeve in this world, it's people claiming someone who had nothing to do with the creation of something were the real originators, because often it means it's just a white European dude getting credit for some shit he didn't really do. So that said, some people did lay the groundwork for singing along with music and a screen. And I feel like I should mention them, but I am not in any way, shape, or form saying that they created karaoke.
We understand that, Ed, but I feel like to really round out the origin story of karaoke in the Western world, too, I feel like some of these names just need to be mentioned. So if you want to, you know.
That's fair. So older listeners, and when I say older, I mean people that are old enough to be my grandparents, might remember that from 1924 to 1927, Red Seal Pictures Corporation produced song cartoons. The first example of a Follow the Bouncing Ball sing-along.
I always love those little bouncing ball sing-alongs. Like when they did the episodes, or they do it at the ballpark still for Take Me Out to the Ball Game, where they'll have, if you're in PNC Park, it's a little smiley face cookie bouncing along. Man, I never knew that, Ed. That's an interesting origin. Tell me more, please.
Yeah, and I mean, those were done by Max Fleischer, who the nerds among us might remember from Betty Boop, Popeye, and the Superman cartoons from the 40s, which were well ahead of their time. But when Max Fleischer left Red Seal and started Fleischer Studios, the series became Screen Songs. So those were originally in theaters from 1929 to 1938 and redone in color in 1945. So I guess track those down if you want to try your hand at Oh, What a Pal Was Mary from 1926.
And I would pay any amount of money for the next time that we go to karaoke for one of us to sing Oh, What a Pal Was Mary, and then share it on our Twitter feed. I think that people want it too.
I'm sure they all do. I'm sure there's a big clamoring for that.
There is. Can't you hear it? It's forming right now, the clamoring. As we're recording, people haven't even listened to it, and the clamoring's already begun. I can feel the energy in the room.
It's impacting the sound quality.
It is.
It's there. And then we should also mention, you know, Mitch Miller, who's best known as an A&R man and producer for Columbia Records. He had the sing-along with Mitch television series and record collections, which means if you've ever shopped for records in a Goodwill in the United States, you've probably seen a sing-along with Mitch record, because that's one of the first things that people donate. The only real connection with karaoke there, though, is the whole lyric on the screen thing. The audience who is watching is singing along with, like, a whole group of singers, not performing themselves.
I mean, there's something to that too. I mean, it's good to get the sing-along in there anyway. Little bubble record, the whole nine yards. It all tied into bringing karaoke into this wonderful, wonderful Western world, or not so wonderful most of the time, world that we live in.
You're somebody who really enjoys doing karaoke in bars. How did karaoke get to American bars?
I'm smiling from ear to ear as I tell this, for a very particular reason. Because My little research that I did for that I bring to the table today for the podcast is I wanted to know, if we're talking about the origins of karaoke in the Western world, particularly in America, where did it all begin? And it had to begin, or at least they claim, at Dimples. Dimples in Burbank, California, you know, with all the fancy people out there.
If I recall correctly, the guy who played Principal Belding on Saved by the Bell used to sing at Dimples a lot.
Sure. There's lots of celebrities supposedly that have gone through the bar. Now, Dimples doesn't exist anymore. I believe it shut down in 2014, even after Bar Rescue. You know the show Bar Rescue? It has that guy that comes in, he yells at people a lot, but he makes the bar look fancy, even though sometimes it doesn't need to look fancy because it already has that kind of perfect dingy appeal. Dimples was rescued because it was America's first karaoke bar, but unfortunately it's still closed in 2014. Sal Ferreiro went to a Hollywood party in 1982 when he came across what they were then calling the singing machine. It was supposedly the first one available in the United States. Sal saw it as a great opportunity. He owned this nightclub called Dimples, and he wanted to bring something new into the equation. So on April 15th, 1982, after a swift purchase of that dusty music box, Dimples was born. Now, like any great karaoke thing, at the time, lyrics had to be read from a book. So it wasn't the singing along on screen where you had the digital tracks that were playing from this music box, but you had a book in front of you with the lyrics. And I kind of like that kind of feel. I think I would like that, just having the book in front of me to read out of, you know, not the menu. That's something different. But just having the book in front of me. I'm just going to read. This is a great article, by the way. This is comes courtesy of valleyrelicsmuseum.org is where I found this information. So if you want to read up, but I'm going to give you a little bit more. So Dimples itself was known for its odd quirks. The bar was filled with all sorts of historic memorabilia, including a dusty camera made by Thomas Edison. The stage held props for singers to utilize, including an often used set of elf ears and the almost mandatory Santa hat. We need more props at karaoke. Do you agree, Ed?
I think that could be arranged.
I think it should be arranged. I think this is something we need to explore. So also at Dimples, as guests prepared to sing, female guests were often taken aback when their song selection got swapped out for My Humps by the Black Eyed Peas.
Ew.
I know, right? That's kind of gross.
It's exceptionally gross.
A common gag used on first-time customers.
Well, I'm certainly gagging now.
Yeah, that is kind of very gaggy. Dimples established itself and succeeded on its karaoke business, but when you offer My Humps to female customers the first time they sing, it's bound to decline when other people get access to the technology that you're using. Competition became stiff. Bar Rescue showed up. They fixed it, and then it fucking closed on April 15th in 2014. So that is your origins of the first karaoke machine in America, for better or for worse. I mean, some people are just going to choose to use their power for evil, it sounds like, Ed.
Yeah, that sounds very much like an American thing. Now, Adam, I know you gave me a trivia challenge, and I'm just going to ask you a one question one. It kind of hits on my sweet spot of 80s romantic comedies.
Oh, shit.
And our shared love of karaoke. Do you know what 1989 romantic comedy was one of the first appearances of karaoke in a movie?
Ooh, I do not know, Adam fans.
It would be the scene in When Harry Met Sally, when Billy Crystal sang a little Surrey with the Fringe on top. And I know you know who that's by. I'm not going to ask you that.
There is the name that jumps to mind, and you're going to destroy me if I'm wrong.
It's a musical.
Surrey with a Fringe on top? See, is that like Mary Poppins or some shit? Because I don't get into it. Is it The Sound of Music? Okay.
It's Oklahoma.
I don't know. I'm not a fan of Oklahoma. Like, I've never really, I'm not going to say I'm not a fan of Oklahoma. To be fair, I've never really listened to Oklahoma. It's just like The Sound of Music, Mary Poppins, that entire era doesn't do anything for me. I think we should do an entire episode on karaoke in media. I think that's something we have to come back and visit.
I think we'll have that on deck at some point here.
I think we definitely need to do that. And we'll find some expert on it, or somebody that claims to be an expert. If you want to claim to be an expert, you can just send us an email, suncorley@gmail.com, say I'm an expert on karaoke and pop culture. I'm like, cool, come talk to us. But as far as the history of karaoke goes, I think we covered the bases a little bit. Do you have any other nuggets, tidbits, factoids, little things for our listening audience to carry with them before we start kind of diving into the person who's the real expert on, you know, music archaeology? This thing called rock and roll, as he would say.
Yeah, I have one little tidbit. I mean, one thing I want people to remember is that singing in public is not a new thing. We've only had recorded music for a little bit over a century.
Yeah,
now,
something
right?
like that.
So how do you think music happened before we had records and tapes and 8-tracks and CDs and Spotify?
I would imagine it would be something a lot akin to like a town crier coming out and standing on a box and just yelling very loudly for the people in a harmonic way to like Beethoven. He just started humming Beethoven or something like that.
People just made music, and there wasn't that barrier to entry where you had to be good to do it. You know, people sang in groups all the time. People sang in public all the time. It's something we kind of got away from once we could hear how much better other people sounded than us. But fortunately, in my case, I never let my lack of skill stop me from doing something I love.
Ed is known to be singing in public. Did I interrupt your... I feel like I interrupted your historical fact right there that you're going to drop on us. Oh, that was a historical fact.
That was it, yes. It's amateur singing has made a comeback through karaoke in a way that I don't think it would have had karaoke not been something that became a fad in the U.S. in multiple time periods.
Hell shout out to all you amateur singers out there doing your thing at karaoke. And it, like, it's kind of wild to think about that. It's such a, like, in the grand scheme of things, karaoke is still a very recent and new thing in the United States. Like, if we're really trusting that 1982 is the first appearance of a singing machine in the United States on karaoke in its current form, like, that's recent. Like, that's within the past 40 years. Like, that's, like, in your lifetime, that's almost in my lifetime. Like, it's very close to my lifetime. It's not, you were like what, like three or something like that when it first hit the United States. So, I mean, like, it's so recent.
Yeah, and I don't remember anything from when I was three.
Good, I think. Not many people remember things when they're three, unless it's very traumatic. So, good. With a big question mark?
Big question mark. Adam, big question mark here. What do we have coming up when we interview an actual expert?
What we have coming up, Ed, is legitimately one of my favorite interviews I think we've done. I've enjoyed every interview we've done on this podcast in its own special way. We talked to the music archaeologist himself and dug deep into some karaoke, but really into a lot of the development of music as we know it as a culture, especially this thing called rock and roll. And he actually proposed something to me that made me think and that I hadn't really thought about before. So I'm excited to share this interview with you. And I really, really hope that you tune in and listen closely, because our rock and roll archaeologist has a lot to say. So let's not waste any more time and cue the guitar already. If there's one thing we love at The Greatest Song Ever Sung Poorly, it's music. If there are two things we love, it's music and music history. Our guest today knows a lot about both, as he is a musician and the person behind the Rock and Roll Archaeology podcast, where he chronicles the history of rock and roll. Christian Swain, welcome to the show.
Adam, Ed, hi, how you doing?
Great. We're so happy that you're here with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. And I just have to say, look, the Rock and Roll Archaeology, I'm not the only one. There's a team behind this to do all of this. So, you know, I need to shout out my writing partner, Richard Evans, my sound designer, Jerry Danielson, and my co-producer, Peter Ferrioli. We put all this thing together 7 years ago and then have built a big, giant music podcast network on top of it now with 90 plus shows.
Wow. That's a lot.
That's absolutely all
music,
incredible.
Yeah, all music related podcasts. So, and all kinds of music, all kinds of genres, takes. It's very diverse. And we love it. In fact, we have our first Spanish language show coming up very shortly called Los Juanchos Habla Metal. I'll let you guys guess from there.
I have some guesses. Yes, but that's absolutely incredible. And you're right. Hey, listen, if you guys haven't listened to, the Rock and Roll Archaeology podcast, you should, because it's clear a team puts together. It's incredibly intricate. It's a great source of information, and it's damn entertaining to listen to.
Thank you, Adam. I really appreciate it. Yeah, there's a lot of work that goes involved. It takes us about 3 to 6 months to research, write, and produce each episode.
That is absolutely wild. But while
we've been working on it for 7 years, and we're at episode 21 now.
Yeah, we hope to hit 21. We're going to be hitting, this is episode 19.
I'm beginning to feel 21. I'm beginning to feel like George R.R. Martin.
Hey, to do good work, it takes time, and you're doing great work.
True. Very, very true. It must distill properly and age to really gain its full weight and measurement of what we expect it to be.
Just like a fine bourbon.
Or a nice glass of wine.
Or both, depending on how the night goes.
Yeah, depending on how the night goes. Right.
Okay, Christian, you're an actual musician. What was your...
Yeah, I pretend to be, but yes. Yeah, yeah.
I believe it, and I don't know any better, so we're going to roll with it.
Yeah, I do okay.
What was your first impression of karaoke?
Oh, you know, originally, I think the first time I saw it, I thought it was awesome. You know, number one, there was a cultural exchange about it, because from my eyes, it came from Japan. And, sushi also came from Japan and things like that. And this was great stuff. So I remember, being intrigued by it, but at the same time, kind of like, well, that's good for the kids. I play real music with real musicians. So, you know, we'll leave that to the regular folk, if it was.
We're glad you left it for the regular folk, because I'm really happy to indulged in it.
We were setting this up, and you mentioned a way karaoke has helped you as a musician with an off-label usage. How does karaoke help the band?
Okay. So, yeah, I have done, a little bit of karaoke. I don't go to karaoke bars specifically to do that. I have my own rock band and go out and play on the weekends. And so that fills my musical soul. So I don't need that. But I think it is great, more than I think not. I will say that karaoke at first, not at first, but over the years, I look out in the audience and where I used to see people wonder, and I mean in awe of how we do what we do, to more of like, I think I could do that too. So then I started to have like a karaoke's kind of eaten into my world of music, because now people think they can do what I do. Because to be a musician, there's a certain level of skill, practice, talent, and determination. You know, I'm now just turned 60, and I've been working at this since I was 16 years old. And I still, it's called a practice for a reason, because you have to keep working it to maintain your skills and then to go on. So to answer your question, about 15 years ago, when I got back into music, because I'd given it a break for about 10 years, I started to find karaoke tracks that I could sing to practice with, just to get my voice back into shape. I started downloading, just tons of these songs that were either really good renditions. And I think it's been recently that literally it's the actual track and they just take the vocal stem out. And so I started using it for that. And then when the band would get new material or we decide on new songs, I'd go and listen to the originals, because we do almost every song in the original key. We do change on a couple of really, really high singers that we have to bring it down. Again, I'm 60. So I found that I can go to karaoke and determine very quickly if the song fits, or at the same time, I can play with it to see if I can fit it into what I do best. So it's been very, very helpful for that. I now immediately, I'll go, if we have a new song, and I'll go and listen to the original several times, get the flavor of the melody, and then we'll go to the karaoke version and we'll test it out. And so it's kind of like it's like a prototype. It's like a test bed for me.
Yeah, that's actually something really interesting. I don't know if we've heard that particular use for karaoke before, but I can completely, see it.
Oh, damn, I'm giving away all my secrets, huh?
I know, those trade industry secrets. Hey, listen, like, I do this with songs, like, I'll sing at a request or a random night, I'll sing just about anything, and I might sound good, I might sound bad, but if I want to work on something to sound bad, like good, when I go out and I'm trying to figure out what my voice is going to set, because it changes over the years, mm-hmm. So I will do the exact same thing. I'll find karaoke tracks of songs that I might want to try to sing and see how I sound with them and start listening to it back. But you're right, it's a completely different ballgame. But okay, so there has to be a difference. Explain to me, like, when you go out to sing karaoke and test these tracks out, how it's different than when you're singing on stage with your band.
Oh yeah, it's hugely different. And to go back to the idea of where I just noticed a change in the audience from complete and utter awe when I was a teenager and in my 20s, to now the feel of like, yeah, I think I could do that, because they've obviously done karaoke. Karaoke is it's a recorded track, so everything is directly on the grid most times, and therefore the first thing is you don't really need a lot of rhythm, because the rhythm is probably 4-4, 3-4, the basic time mm-hmm. signatures that you're going to get out there. And then it's the lyrics are there, the melody you probably heard 100 times. And so it's all in a box and it's well controlled. Once you start getting humans involved, a lot of that control kind of goes away. There are differences in the flavor of each time you perform, and everything is not exactly on the grid. especially in a live performance, unless you're, you know, really doing click track type songs, EDM, disco type songs, which are really, really tightly, on that grid, even in a live performance, you know, it'll still be tight like that. So with musicians, they're going to do different things. And it's a very different experience to get up and have those other musicians and you gel if you haven't been doing it together for a while. Now I know there's still like live bands that do like they pretend to be karaoke sort of thing. Like they know a bunch of songs. And so you kind of come, I would assume they have a book and you go through the book and these are the songs they know. And they know probably a couple.
There's quite a few out there. Some great, some less than great. There's a great punk rock karaoke band out your way. There was a fantastic karaoke band out my way.
If I was going to do a karaoke band, it would be a punk rock karaoke band, because then I know I could get through the songs because it's only about three chords in each one. The singers will have a lot of fun. Yeah.
The amazing thing about the one that they had out here, though, was the one guy who was in it was also a computer programmer. So he actually developed software that the bass player controlled with his foot, but the lyrics actually scrolled on a screen just like regular in-bar karaoke. It was amazing.
It was amazing. Well, yeah, it was sort of fun.
Well, let me tell you a little secret. So, you know, again, because of age and also the fact that, you know, we probably know 120 to 140 songs at any given time. We actually probably know more than that, but we've, you know, let songs go. And if somebody said, hey, do you know that song? We'd go, oh, yeah, let's try this one at rehearsal a couple of times and we'll be ready. We can do it again. I can't remember all the lyrics anymore. So I literally have a teleprompter now in front of me, which is like a karaoke machine. It doesn't exactly scroll. I just have a page and then I have a foot pedal that I can switch to the next page as I need to. So very similar to how karaoke works. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And so you said, you know, 150 some songs that you guys have. Your musical knowledge is really in depth. You know a lot of genres, you know a lot of time periods. How did you get into being a music historian?
Wow, that is a great question. I think that I've always been a music historian. In fact, I probably started off as a music historian more than a musician, because I was really interested in, and I am, as you have probably discerned from the podcast, I'm really a cultural observer more than anything else. I like how culture works, because I think culture is the first take of history. It's in real time. What's happening is we are seeing things that are bubbling up from the bottom of the sea and rise to the top. And that is in that top, you know, 1 inch of the ocean is what we call culture. And that's what people focus on. And that is what history remembers. And if the further you go in time, the less we get to keep an eye on that stuff that was bubbling underneath that rose to the top. The deeper that you get into history and to academia, especially, the deeper you can go into that ocean. But weirdly, the further you go back in time, the less you're going to get to the bottom, to where things begin. But the 20th century is about recorded history. I mean, almost the entire 20th century was recorded in one form or another. First in audio, you know, which was available, cameras still, and then film, you know, all came together. And then into television, which is mass media and broadcasting. And so, you know, our whole existence of humanity has really, really been recorded for the first time in the last about 100 years. In fact, a lot of people ask me, you know, how come you start this rock and roll archaeology podcast in the 1950s instead of, say, the 1920s, because that's really when that story does begin. And that, while that's true, I'll leave that to other folks to get to that. And who knows, maybe we'll do from 1920 to 1950 in the future. But what I saw is that the maturity happens in music in the 1950s, because rock and roll, this thing called rock and roll, and by the way, I consider that all the music that was made in the late 20th century, I just call it the rock and roll era, the period. Mm-hmm. It's when music jumped out of being in the background to being in the foreground. Music has been, if you talk to older generations, you know, it wasn't life itself. It was, you know, something to enjoy. It was entertainment. It was something to, you know, have, again, like I said, in the background. But starting in the 1950s with the beginning of youth culture and, you know, young people having disposable income to be able to utilize that, this thing called rock and roll appeared, and it became a giant thing, especially, you know, 10 years later in 1964 when the Beatles show up on Ed Sullivan. It literally is like the cultural experience of the 20th century. We're getting a chance to see a little bit of it here with Peter Jackson's new Get Back 6-hour documentary, just how important those guys were. And, you know, to me, everything begins and ends with the Beatles. They're the top of the mountain. And I don't think anything will ever change. And I also feel that we're at the end of that story. And I think that story ended somewhere between 95 and 2005. The music industry is not what it was prior to 2005. The last great rock and roll genre would probably be grunge in the mid 90s. Although, you know, power punk, you know, Green Day and people Offspring and people like that kind of had this thing going on. Because, you know, and the other reason why I kind of hesitate is that 2004, 2005, American Idiot comes out, and that is the last charting number one rock and roll album that's been since then. So I think I may have lost the question, but how did I become this? You know, it's really how to become a musician, you know, and instead of just learning, because I don't read or write music. Oh, that's not true. I did used to write music, but by ear. I'm solely ear trained. I figured, well, geez, I'll just read everything I can about these folks. And so, you know, it started with album and liner notes and went to magazine articles, which were, you know, quite ubiquitous at the time. And then into books and more books and more books and more books. And that's all I read for like 7 years is nothing but rock and roll books.
Okay, then you're going to be perfect. You are the subject matter expert that can answer my next question. Then this is what I've been waiting for personally. Okay, because I'm
on the spot.
I'm ready. Okay, here's what I got. I'm always intrigued when I go to karaoke that this younger, like a younger generation tends to embrace certain songs that are outside of their era. But it's not all of them. You know, it's not this thing called rock and roll. It's not all the songs that are produced that live and breathe and are still coming up every single generation embraces them. What do you think it is about certain songs that gives them that kind of staying power?
Well, let's face it. There are certain songs that just, you know, just time will never forget. And you can go back to, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan or great songwriters of the 19th century that still, you know, there's less and less as time goes on. You know, one thing that I'll say is like, while all of us love, you know, the music of the late 20th century, we think it's extraordinary. And it definitely was an extraordinary period of time. Highly unlikely it'll ever be repeated. But 500 years from now, people are going to know the Beatles and maybe Bob Dylan. And that's about it, because that's just the way history and time works. You know, everybody else is going to be a Salieri, and there's only going to be a couple of Mozarts when you get right down to it. Now, I'll hedge that a little bit by saying, because everything was recorded and for the first time it was kind of perfected. And that's what you really see with this audio format is, you know, in the 50s, it gets okay. In the 60s, it gets much better. And then by the time you get in the 70s, it just sounds, the sonic palette and quality is perfection. And in fact, we've been arguing about that since then, of whether digital or analog is best and things like that. So what that tells me is that, yeah, we probably peaked sonic quality, or at least sonic innovation might be a good word to good couple of words to use, probably in the mid to late 70s, maybe the early 80s. I might throw in electronic music like the DX7 and some of these synthesizers that became cheap enough to be in the hands of the regular people, that because, you know, the best music, especially this music that we're talking about, bubbles up from the from the bottom, from the common man. And that's a great answer to your question, especially with the music of the last 50, 60 years and it constantly coming back and the next generation finding these nuggets in it, that the sonic quality of that song, of these songs, and the competition that existed between that group of people, you know, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, Bob Dylan, the Band, Eagles, Pink Floyd. Yes, I could go on and on and on. But it's just this whole thing that came together and created this huge explosion at the origins of what's called youth culture, which never really existed before that. Sure, there were teenagers, but they had no power. They were children until they became adults. Then we created this middle ground thing here. So now there's this expectation of you going through this period of time here, not a child, not an adult, but this new thing called the teenager. And that's really when we determine our music. Somewhere around 15, 16, 17 years old, you're kind of locked into what your likes and dislikes are. So it's no surprise that certain songs come back each generation that means similar things to that next generation. You know, here's a song. I'll give you a song that I never would have thought would mean in constant generations, but I've seen it become a big thing in three generations, and that's Bohemian Rhapsody. You know, it was huge. It wasn't a huge hit when it first came out, but in the underground, it was like, holy fuck, what did those people do? Anybody that had any kind of musical inclination would have gone, this is crazy shit that was coming out of the speakers. And then, of course, you know, Wayne's World in the 90s brought it back. And then now the movie brought it back again. So it's three lifetimes that that particular song has had. And I must say, well-deserved.
Yeah, that is one of the songs that popped into my head when I was thinking of that question. The other one specifically was Don't Stop Believin' by Journey. Oh. Seems to, I know that's a reaction a lot of people have right there. And listen, I'm not gonna argue for Journey, but I just wanted to
get No. You can argue along. No. I'll argue with you on Journey.
No,
so
I have no
pro and con. I can take either side.
I have no.
You pick interest. One, I'll pick the other. No problem.
I have no interest in arguing about Journey, but I am gonna just want to throw out there that I'm gonna slightly disagree with you a little bit about the teenagers forming your music opinion. You're locked in because when I was a teenager. And the era I grew up, my favorite bands were Korn, Limp Bizkit, Kid Rock, and Eminem. That was
I believe that's called new metal. Well, Eminem is hip hop.
Yeah, it was hip hop. It was new metal. And like, yeah. Listen, I look back at that era in my life and that point in my life. And like a lot of this stuff, I'm like, I don't understand how this was like my day to day. These were the albums I loved and like listened to. And it's strange how music tastes evolved too, because I still remember the first CDs that I got. There were three of them that I count as my very first CDs, the very first time I had music for my own when I was younger. I can't remember the exact age, but the three albums that my parents gave me for my very own were Boys to Men. It was Sublime. It was Tag Team. I think the name of the album was, whoop, there it is.
I'm not even sure I knew who they are.
Tag Team, Back Again. Check It's a Wrecking, Let's Begin.
Party on, party people, let me hear some noise. Right. In the house, jump, jump, rejoice.
Whoop, there it is.
Oh, that I know.
Tag Team. Those were the three albums that I got. So like it's just like strange how music tastes evolve. And like now I'm settled firmly in. Ed got me into learning about the history of hip hop and becoming more of a hip hop head. I've explored the rock and roll scene, the indie scene. Like I can just appreciate country. I appreciate music for what it is anymore. It's a beautiful
Adam,
thing.
Adam, I'm having a revelation that while I still believe that your basic music tastes, and it's not just me, I've read this from a bunch of music psychologists and things like that, that you kind of make that determination. But the plethora and the ease of having music at your fingertips.
Oh, yeah.
Does change that dynamic quite a bit. I mean, when I was buying music back in the day, when I had to make choices, I only had so many dollars in my pocket, and I had to choose this one or that one, even though they were both great. I don't have to choose anything anymore. I can listen to whatever I want, whenever I want, for as long as I want. And that's pretty extraordinary, but at the same time, it does cheapen it a little bit. It makes it less valuable, obviously. And recorded music, you know, is not valuable. today. That is just the first step in making it in the business nowadays. You have a song, you hope that song gets picked up. In fact, you know, I listen and read to a lot of articles and professionals that say that the way you know you made it today is when your song gets in a commercial or a television show or a movie or something like that. And that's when you get your payday. And that's sad, other than being on the road. And again, if you're not a real musician out there working to gain an audience, you don't really have a road world. And I will say this too, that through karaoke, YouTube, what I've seen recently is a bit of a return to what I might call more organic music. I think we've lived through 10 years of, you know, Dr. Luke and Max Martin basically writing every pop song in the world, which has been perfected. It's, you know, an algorithm that they follow. There's about 20 writers on this thing to eke out every little tiny mistake or something that doesn't quite lead to the next thing. It's almost like script doctors nowadays. And just really putting all of this time and effort into making everything exactly perfect. Well, people aren't perfect. And while we are entranced by the technology, very quickly we get bored of that. And I think what we're seeing is a backlash to the last 10 or so years of this perfected pop song into people wanting something more organic and more real. And where you get that is by, you know, human interaction with an actual instrument. And I think that part of why we went this other way is because, let's face it, the computer took over as the dominant composing instrument from the guitar, which was the dominant composing instrument of the past 50 years or 60 years. And now you have this keyboard, not an actual keyboard, but a computer keyboard, which, you know, anybody can learn fairly quickly and be able to put a song that sounds like a song together, without a lot of effort. And so to master an instrument, though, takes a lot of effort. But with YouTube and the ability for these kids to just grab a guitar and then get on and say, I want to learn this song. And there's like 50 guys who will teach you exactly how to learn that song. You have to go to a lesson. You have to do this. All you got to do is watch this YouTube video and then practice it. And a week later, you master that one and you're on to the next song. So you can become proficient in an instrument much quicker today than you could in the past. And I think we're starting to see this revolution return to a more organic approach.
You mentioned the, you know, technological changes and how things change over time. And it makes me wonder, how do you see the attitudes in singing in public changing over time? I'm thinking specifically of things like music sales charts, because, you know, before we had LPs and before we had records, and obviously then before CDs and tapes and all of that, sales charts were sheet music. Are we seeing like a switch back to that then, with people being more comfortable making music on their own?
That's a complicated question. So let me take it in a couple different parts. First, I might say that nothing beats the concert experience. Nothing ever, ever beats being it with a group of people and enjoying a blissful moment by these people that are doing something that is closest thing to magic live in front of you. And on a really good night with a really good band, believe me, you're never going to experience anything like that. There's nothing in this world that competes with that. And that's what makes music life, and why music is so personal to people, more so than movies or televisions or books. Music is really that thing that, for those of us who even have a remote interest in it, it just sets our world on fire. The computation of what is success has changed a lot, especially in the last 20 years. You know, Napster, 1997, and that's another reason why a lot of people say, why do I quit at 95 and say 95 is going to be the end? It's because Napster shows up and changes the whole landscape, and music is not culturally as relevant as it once was, because it becomes ubiquitous. It becomes so easy to get everything. You don't have to make choices. And if you don't have to make choices, you have to make decisions on how to spend your money. It's less valuable. It's just the way the world works. It's just human psychology. So the charts now, number one, the album itself to me is a dead art form. Unless you're going to make a concept album, you know, that holds together, you know, something I'm talking about something like Hamilton, you know, that really is a full story, three acts, well thought out, then what's the point? The song is the key. And it's always been about the song. Whether you're determining whether the sheet music is the metric of success, or the Billboard Hot 100 is the measure of success, or the Spotify Top 50. It's all about the song. It's always, always, always been about the song. And those who can do it and do it well and do it for a long time, those are the gods and goddesses. Those are the people we remember. You know, again, going back to the Beatles, watching the documentary and watching them invent Get Back and Let It Be in the first episode is just, to me, it's like watching Shakespeare write. Or if I can take it another step, because it's the Beatles, it's like watching Jesus Christ on, you know, Sermon on the Mount, actually giving the Sermon on the Mount. And you're like, oh, he said things way different than what we got today, you know, things like that. So it's really incredible. You know, Adele comes to mind recently, just, you know, continues to just focus on songs and then putting a vocal performance that just slays on that song. And boom, there's your formula.
I'm kind of speechless right now, because I'm just really appreciating the perspective you're bringing this, Christian, because you've introduced me to some thoughts that I've never really thought of before, especially the fact of, with everything being so available, that we don't have to make a choice anymore, and that's pulling away from the identity. That's honestly something I've never explored, and I appreciate you bringing that to the table. Like, this is why we were really excited to bring you on the show. But to transition on to something a little bit different now, here on The Greatest Song Ever Sung Poorly, we like to put our guests through a little game we like to call Hit Me With Your Best Shot. Hit me with
Does
your best shot.
Does that mean I have to sing Pat Benatar? Because
I mean, only I if may, you want
I,
to.
I may be old, but I you know, I'm not not be able to hit those sort of highs. But
only if you want to, Christian. We would never forcibly make you do so. But we will forcibly make you answer 5 quick fire questions about karaoke, and we'll adjust it. If you don't think you have the karaoke know-how, or you don't have a strong opinion, maybe we can adjust it to some music-based ones. And I figure you'll have some strong opinions there, so I think we'll be okay.
I usually have strong opinions on just about everything. So. I'll make one up.
Yes, that is exactly what we want to hear. Now, at the end of these 5 questions, which I'm sure you're going to do great with, you have an opportunity to fire away if you'd like, which means that after you get to ask Ed and I a question about literally anything, and we solemnly swear that we will answer honestly. We've had questions about karaoke and some questions about not karaoke of varying levels while we've been doing this. So, so in your karaoke going experience, or we'll say your performing experience in general, what's the absolute best thing you've seen happen?
Oh, you know, there's always like the silent person, or the sad sack, or the person you just don't, you know, you're unexpectedly gets up on the microphone and belts something and sounds like Adele, and you just go, holy shit. That's always a great thing. It's always wonderful to see.
It is. But you know what,
people coming out of their shell and doing, you know, doing something.
I'm taking this back, because I want a specific, so I'm changing this question. We're going to start all over again. I'm going to change the question, because I have a better question.
I failed.
No, you didn't fail. I just have a question that I'm infinitely curious about, so I'm going to make this about me now, interviewing you, okay? What's your favorite concert-going experience of all time? The favorite concert that you've attended, or one that sticks out vividly in your memory where you remember the magic of that evening?
Wow. I mean, I've been to a lot of fucking great concerts. Let me just tell you that every time I saw the Rolling Stones, Prince opened, Pearl Jam opened, Guns N' Roses opened. The last time it was an unknown band, but that's pretty fucking great right there. Opening, okay? I saw the Wall Tour in 1980 with Pink Floyd. All 21 shows, that's it, that's all they did. And something that was like Broadway on steroids. It was something I'd never seen in my life. It was extraordinary. But first concert I ever went to, Queen, 1978. So I got to see Freddie do Bohemian Rhapsody and everything else. So, I mean, I got to see Freddie 3 times. So to see that, I think that's still the most impactful moment in my life, because I'd just gotten in my first band, and that was my first concert. And, you know, who does not want to be Freddie Mercury after seeing that?
Yep, that's what I was looking for.
By the way, my wife also saw Freddie Mercury in Pittsburgh on that same tour.
Jesus. Wow. Yeah. That must have
so
been amazing.
So we were meant to be, I think, is how we look at that.
It sounds like it. Adam always takes the positive side, so I'm going to go with the negative route. What's the worst thing you've seen at karaoke? And then, I guess, pairing off of Adam's question, if you don't have the worst thing you've seen at karaoke, what's the worst show you've been to?
Okay. Well, let me take the karaoke question first. I mean, obviously, it's the drunk idiot who gets up there that makes a fool of themselves, of which probably happens almost every night that karaoke happens. Somebody sooner or later does that. So, I mean, I don't have like a specific sort of karaoke night where I just went, oh my God. I'll reverse it for you and tell you, look, I've been in bands since I was 16 years old. I've been playing in front of fights, gang fights, you know, 20, 30 people going at it in front of me. And by the way, just so you know, the managers say, if that happens, you keep on playing because the music is supposed to calm them down while the bouncers deal with that. I've never seen a fight break out at a karaoke bar.
That's fair.
You've mentioned you've been in bands since you were 15 or 16. I need you to share with me and the podcasting listening audience what the worst band name you've been a part of is.
Okay. All right. It's two. Either Fax, F-A-X. I knew it at the time. Now, look, this never happens when I pick the fucking name, okay? Somebody else picked that name. Of course, it was new technology at the time. Hey, Fax. You know, if you think about it sonically, it's kind of cool. Fax. You know, what does that mean? You know, facsimile. It's real, but it's not real. You know, whatever. Okay. I know you guys are both busting up. Okay. And then this one only lasted a short period of time because I put a kibosh on it. 1990. In 1989. And I was very quickly of like, what happens when we get to 1991? And that was the end of that name.
So let's say you're traveling and you somehow get roped into giving an impromptu show or it's a karaoke night, but you can only sing one song. You've got to only sing one song. What song are you going to sing to make your mark?
I don't need a whole lot of money. I don't need a big fine car. I got everything that a man could want. I got more than I can ask for. I don't have to run around. I don't have to stay out all night. Cause I got me a sweet loving woman. And she knows just how to treat me right. Oh, my baby, she's all right. Oh, my baby's clean out of sand. Don't you know that she's some kind of wonderful, oh yeah. Some kind of wonderful, some kind of wonderful, yeah.
Clearly fucking illustrated. Well done, Christian.
That was the best way that question's ever been answered, and I don't know if that will ever be topped, ever.
Oh, somebody will top it, I'm sure.
We'll see. So on the kind of transverse of that, I guess, would be, okay, so with that being said, what's the one song you would strike from every karaoke playlist forever?
Oh, Ice Ice Baby.
Great.
Just because that song needs to be destroyed for all time.
Did he steal it?
Of course he stole it, but greater people have stolen greater things. So, you know, I don't give him a hard time about that, but I do give him a hard time about the explanation. Why don't you just admit that?
Yeah, it was a
fucking
Christian,
great groove, man.
And but Christian,
I fucking added a bunch of shit on top of it.
So. His goes, dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
Duh. Okay.
No, it's the same. It's the same riff, man.
Oh yeah, we all know it. I just needed to throw it in there. But that was it. That was easy. I hope it wasn't too difficult.
Oh no, it was great. It was fantastic. Yeah.
You have the chance to fire away now. So if you'd like to, you can ask Ed and I any question. Solemnly swear to answer it honestly. So hit us with fire away.
Okay. Who with the two of you when you both walk into a karaoke bar to give the most closest pronunciation that this white person can do? Who's the most competitive?
I'm going to answer that. I'm going to say Adam is the most competitive because Adam's a highly competitive person. And Adam's a really great singer, but I'm also a highly competitive person. And I will say I own a stage better than Adam.
Oh yeah. You're okay. So you've got the front man moves. So you got the moves like Jeff.
Wait. Let's pause for just a second right now, Christian. You own a stage just because the songs you pick demand you own a stage. just because you can't sing.
That's fair. That's fair. That's very fair.
You have to own the stage. You have to own the stage. If you can sing, you don't need to own a stage. I don't need to do "Let Me Clear My Throat" and walk around holding the microphone to people. Like, I don't need to do that shit. If I needed to, I could get into this head. We're going to throw down next time I see you. I can own a stage damn well, too.
Oh, I look forward to it.
Do the Roger Daltrey, mic twirl.
I think a karaoke DJ would kill us.
Yeah.
Don't fuck with the microphone, man. All right. So last question, and this is a follow-up to my question. What's the strangest thing that you've seen at a show? Have you ever seen, people, fight it out over a song? Like, no, you can't sing that one. I'm going to sing that one, and really get, down and dirty with the whole thing.
I actually have seen that. Yeah. I don't understand the thought behind it. Like, you don't own the songs. You don't own the publishing to the songs. You don't own the right to sing the song. But I have seen people, if not actually throwing fists, getting close to it because you sang my song.
Weird.
Yeah, it's really weird. Anytime there's any kind of conflict that happens, like something at karaoke, it's always like the weirdest thing. I mean, I think the closest thing I got is I watched a bachelor party almost beat the shit out of each other over who was singing Snoop Dogg and who was singing Dr. Dre.
There you go.
And
was
somehow
that in Nashville, by the way.
No, it was in the. It was in North Carolina.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. Christian, that's all we had for you. We really appreciate you taking the time to do this. We like to give the floor to our guests so they can plug anything they got going on. Tell the people social media. Tell them shows. Tell the people what to do so they can get more of you in everything awesome that you bring to the table.
Well, real quickly, if anybody wants to see my little rock and roll cover band here that we play here in throughout Northern California, that's tinmanmusic.net. You can go to the website there and check out what we're up to and where we're playing, especially if you're local. We play all over Northern California. Mostly spring, summer, and fall is the big time for us. We do a lot of outdoor type of stuff and parties and festivals. Wine type festivals and things like that. But really the big thing is pantheonpodcasts.com. That is, the home of the gods and goddesses of music discussion. We have 90 plus shows now looking at, as many different types of music that we can find out there. We're constantly plugging holes to fill up things of unique nature. We don't want to get pigeonholed in a particular genre or a particular era or anything like that. We are about all music all the time and plan on continuing to grow in that direction. So come and join us. I'm sure you will find something you like. You can go to our main feed, the Pantheon feed itself, of which we stick all of our shows in. It seems like a much, but it's kind of like, think of it like a sampler plate. And then if you find something you really like, you can subscribe to that particular show and enjoy the heck out of it.
Great, Christian. Thank you so much. We had so much fun talking to you. And again, I think the singing the answer to the question was probably going to be one of the highlights of this season of the podcast.
For sure. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. I had a great time. It was a lot of fun. Really enjoyed chatting with you. And, like I said, karaoke helps me, become a better singer. It's a technology that's now out and available for anybody to use. You can practice at home and then go out into the bars and do your thing. But just remember, when you see a live band out there doing it, it's a lot harder than it looks.
And you will never hear any disagreement on this podcast, guaranteed. All right. Thanks again, Christian. We hope to see you out and about sometime soon.
While Christian has done karaoke, Christian's not really a karaoke guy, but what Christian is a musician. Here is Christian singing along with his band, Tin Man. Altogether, they're playing Heroes by David Bowie. Thank you.
one day. And we can be heroes forever and ever.
To thank each and every one of you. You don't think it's you that's listening right now, but it's actually you that I'm talking to, for joining us today. We really hope you enjoyed all the historical facts and figures and all the notes and music trivia we brought to the table to educate you, our loyal listeners, on the ways of karaoke and music to a certain extent today. And if you did appreciate all that, I just want to say, according to Ed, we're social guys. Him and I, we're social guys. So you can follow us on all the socials, which I'm assuming is short for social media. And it's just like a cool thing that kids say nowadays because Ed's in touch with the cool. So on all the socials, we're at Sung Poorly. And that's Twitter, that's Facebook, that's Instagram. And the latest edition, TikTok. I think I said several episodes ago that we would be on TikTok at some point. And here we are, two middle-aged men, TikToking like all the youths. And the kids.
And speaking of other wonderful middle-aged men, a massive shout out to our friend Ben Dumm for our theme song Gasoline. Make sure you check out his latest project, the Ben Dumm 3, on Spotify or other music platforms. And a massive shout out to you if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, because that really helps us spread the karaoke gospel.
Oh, we love spreading the karaoke gospel. And as part of spreading that gospel, you need to make sure to tune in 2 weeks when we explore karaoke in a fictional universe with a guest uniquely qualified to discuss the happenings in Universe 616, which Ed assures me I will understand when the time comes. That's it. That's all. There is no more. So until next time, I'm Adam Wainwright.
I'm Ed Kennard.
And remember that singing off key is still technically singing.
Like to feature the guest singing karaoke when possible. You know, we'd be more than happy to air
that. Sing something?
If you want to sing live, absolutely. You're braver than most.